hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome to A Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, a Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am James Lark, sitting in this seat, this commentary seat, this metaphorical commentary seat, because it's not a real seat. Joe doesn't mail a seat around. That would be a very inefficient way of running a podcast. No, I brought my own seat to this. But nevertheless, in a metaphorical sense, I'm sitting in this seat for the first time, and possibly after this introduction, the last time. And with me... You did tell me to make it up as I went along, and that's what I did.
Congratulations. What the hell do you think the budget is for this podcast? Mail a seat to everybody.
Metaphorical seat.
I'll start doing it. I did send you a picture, though, didn't I?
You did send me a picture, and that went straight on my wall. Lovely picture of Croton the Cyberman.
Marvellous. Well, Jack, while we're here today, what are we doing?
We are doing a commentary on Delta and the Bannermen, one of the many high points of Sylvester McCoy's era in Doctor Who, which is itself a high point of Doctor Who.
And we've talked about how sort of maligned it was at the time, and I will say unjustly maligned. I think you could say this is objectively a good piece of television.
Yeah. On no grounds could you say it was not a good piece of television. And I also think it's a really interesting, entertaining piece of television, which good television isn't always those things. So I think it's not only aspiring to a kind of greatness within a very kind of small set of parameters, you know, knowingly small set of parameters, it's being quite ambitious, but it's also succeeding in being a cracking good watch.
Is this the first story all done on location since the Sontaran experiment? It is, isn't it?
Well, it's not all done on location, though, because there was a scene in the TARDIS.
Oh, of course.
But they filmed that during one of the Dragonfire recordings.
Oh, okay. And that's...
But you're right. So this is John Nathan Turner's great idea, wasn't it, to split the
genius
location work and the studio work into two different stories. And it absolutely reaps dividends, because we get stories like Survival, and we get stories like Ghostlight. You know, that's the flip side of those two arrangements, isn't it?
You've got a script editor there that's strong enough to play to the strengths of both an all-location story and an all-studio story.
Yeah.
Those are two great. I mean, I think Curse of Fenric's probably the best all-location story of the era.
Yeah, although that one wasn't meant to be all-location. That's one of the studio ones with location work, where they suddenly go, actually, look, we've got this location. Can we make it work all in location? So, but again,
yes.
Would that have happened if they hadn't had 2 years' experience of making stuff all in location and worked out how to make that work? I don't think so.
Well, because
it's all
this
paying
is,
forward into,
like you
into
said,
what,
this is the learning curve season, isn't it? They're figuring out what works and what doesn't, very entertainingly so. But I think it's smoother in 25, and then it's really smooth in 26.
It is. In terms of the learning curve, though, I don't think any of the rest of this season comes close to Delta and the Bannermen for just the confident way in which it just does it and makes it look pretty effortless.
You know how Doctor Who tends to sort of pick at things that are in the zeitgeist at the time that are popular? So was genocide popular at the time? Was there,
there
lots
was quite
of satellites?
A lot of genocide in the 80s.
Satellites in space, Heidi High, was there lots of things set in holiday camps?
No,
it's such a weird
this story
mashup.
Is...
I just want to figure out where it all comes from.
I don't know where it all comes from, and some of it is obviously a throwback. Like, they've gone, let's make one set in the 50s, because they know that the BBC can do period, and it works beautifully. So nostalgia for kind of 50s holiday camps. That wasn't in the zeitgeist. Like I say, Heidi High was more of a 70s sitcom, wasn't it? And it was was it still running in 87? If it was, it was only just.
It was on its way out, yeah. But
so it's not. This is not ahead of the curve in terms of its frames of reference, but in terms of what it chooses to bung together, I would say it's very progressive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a disparate mix of elements that somehow it all blends together really, really well.
It does work, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, shall we pop along into episode 2 and see what it has to offer? Have we met Gromway yet? We haven't, have we?
We haven't, no. Another treat to come.
Okay. Well, I'll count us in this time then, because you introed us in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Off we go. Exploding stars.
And these graphics haven't aged badly, have they?
Oh, I don't think so.
Or is that just my heart saying that? I feel like apart from those rocks, which always looked a little bit dodgy to me, I think the TARDIS in a bubble is still absolutely great.
The way that sort of cloud comes towards you and then we go sort of over the top of it, it's got depth to it, hasn't it?
It's got absolute 3D-ness. It's more 3D than Dimensions in Time.
I will point out that Janet Fielding, Annika Wills and Sarah Sutton were deeply unimpressed with both the music and the title sequence. But I'll also point out that Janet Fielding is generally unimpressed with anything to do with Doctor
Pretty
Who.
Pretty much anything, so yeah.
It's not uncommon.
I always feel for them when they're watching stuff for the first time in those behind-the-sofa features, though, because they're clearly not watching the whole episode.
No.
Because they don't have the money to do that. So it must just be baffling for them, really. And they're having to form a judgment, you know, on something that they can't really listen to properly because they're talking through it.
Well, some of their critiques are plot points that they haven't seen.
Yeah, absolutely. They're like, so, oh, that doesn't make sense.
It's not fair on the story, and it's not fair on them.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe his shoes smoke in a minute.
This is a great ready-made set as well, the shelves, and apparently the toweling and bedding was all on them already.
Have you
just
read,
gives it depth of field and
Malcolm Cole's Target novelization?
I haven't actually.
Oh, okay. Did you know the famous line from that, the misprint?
No.
Oh, so it's supposed to say the Doctor was peering over the shelf, and it says he was peeing over the shelf. Unfortunately, that's a bit of an infamous line.
Well,
in the novel now.
Last episode, we brought you Sylvester McCoy's prostate form. Now he's peeing over the shelf, so clearly all is back to rights with the prostate.
Oh, this is so sweet. She's worth nothing for you. Let her go.
I love their faces. Look at their eyes. It's a instantly gorgeous dynamic they have.
Look at how Gavroche's lit there from below.
And then we get some comedy shoes.
Yeah.
That's a little bit CBBC, isn't it?
Well, there's a few bits in this that are a little bit. I mean, that puppet that came out with the man's thumb in it was a bit CBBC as well.
The baby's good, I think. I don't know why people are down on the baby. And look, she's got a slightly green sheen and she's got green spots in her dress. I don't know, it's quite subtle.
I bet that baby made a bloody racket, all those hydraulics.
Is it hydraulics or is someone sticking their hand up inside it?
How? She's sitting on a bench.
Well, yeah, but it could be. There are all sorts of theatrical tricks. Like, no, okay, I can now see from the long angle, it's definitely a hydraulic deal.
This is the bit
they probably
I was talking
reused
about.
Those for the cat in Survival, didn't they?
That fade into the morning. It's just, again, it's something of the sort of thing we haven't seen for a long time.
And also then cutting to a character we haven't met before. Beekeeping in a different location. Feels like proper drama.
And it's just great because it's two characters that are lovely and another character that are lovely coming together. It's just lovely.
In a nice car.
Good morning. What a beautiful morning it
is. Just such a good looking... I mean, what a great location.
Yeah. They should shoot in Wales more often, you know.
They should. So this is Barry Island, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. That's where they shot Gavin and Stacey, isn't it? That's where I know that most from.
Right. So Barry Island is also where all of the scrapped railway locomotives went to when British Rail... or British Railways, as they were then, decided to get rid of steam and introduce diesels. And what were they called? The Woodford brothers, maybe, decided to buy up all of the railway engines for scrap metal, took them all to Barry Island. And fortunately, before they could break up they started with the rolling stock first. Sorry, Doctor Who fans, we'll get back
no,
to
No, go
Who
on, go on.
Before breaking up all the railway engines, the locomotives, they broke up the rolling stock, the carriages and trucks for metal. So when people realised that these old locomotives were there and could be bought back, they were still there and they started to do that. So the reason that heritage railways can run trains that are hauled by locomotives that actually used to do it is purely because one company bought the whole lot up and put them on Barry Island.
I was just seeing a fantastic Doctor Who story set in, you know, decayed trains in a massive
I
space.
I would be there for that.
Wouldn't
absolutely.
It be great?
Why have they never done that?
I know, there's not enough things set on trains, if you ask me. And I love going on a steam train as well. There's one that goes from Yorkshire right through to Whitby Bay. It's
oh,
the
gorgeous.
Best
Yeah.
journey. That baby's changed a bit.
The baby goes through some quite considerable changes in this episode, and I'm not sure it's quite sells it. I'm not sure that costume quite sells it as the same baby, if I'm honest.
No.
Nice motorbike.
Very nice. Can I offer a slight criticism of Delta and the Bannermen? I think the actress who plays Delta is a little wooden. I do believe the chemistry between the two. I do think it's nicely played between them. But the way she delivers her line, she's doing sort of Doctor Who, I am an alien acting.
I agree. It's a choice. I'm not sure it quite works next to Bonnie Langford, even though Bonnie's now pitching her before. I think she's seen herself on television by this stage.
Yeah, what am I doing?
Okay, I don't need to do quite so much. So yeah. She's pitching it just right, I think, for a Doctor Who companion. But the problem is when you've got someone being very wooden next to you, even though if it had been filmed differently, more in close-up, I think it could have worked, but it's not quite the right choice for...
There's a coldness to her. There's not a lot of warmth.
Oh, no, I love this. Look.
Me, 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 me. Good morning. Let's start with a song. Do you want me to keep going? When the red robin comes bobbing along.
Now look, that scene has got nothing to do with plot at all, but it's beautiful. It's beautifully played. It's so authentically Naff Holiday Camp.
He gets a little subplot though, doesn't he? Because he's like, Mr. Burton, I'm not going. I'm staying with you.
But that scene is enough to kind of establish him as that character, the second in command who doesn't want to leave the camp. It's the me.
And he even gets a joke when they're all running for the bus and he's the last one, isn't he, with his suitcase, trying to get on the bus to get away.
He was ionized.
You're right. She does struggle with the accent a bit. A few space only known to Billy and me.
So they were knocked out. They spent the whole night on the floor of that. I'd be pretty cranky if I'd woken up after a night on the floor of a laundry.
Do you know what I love though is how Mel knows immediately who the Bannermen are. So there's an unseen Doctor Who adventure featuring Mel and the Bannermen out there somewhere. How Big Finish haven't made that is astonishing.
Don't put ideas in their head.
No. Oh, look at that. What a lovely location.
It's so beautiful. I think that's another reason why Bonnie didn't need to be so disappointed by this. It's such a good-looking show.
Mm. Oh, this is the scene that Doctor Who fans point at. You know, all the, you know, shall we have space buns and tea or don't they drink tea on Mars? You know.
I love it. I love how seriously he's playing it. He's giving a really realistic response to an absurd situation.
But and he gets laugh. To be the comedy hero. Yeah. I think Burton's great. Oh, although something does happen. Is he a Welshman? I don't think he is. And do you know why I don't think he is? Because he has a line on location later when he's outside the TARDIS and he hasn't got the accent.
He's speaking Welsh now. I think he is Welsh.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm mishearing things.
So is this where now they're going to use the TARDIS to persuade him?
Yeah, it does happen a lot in the 80s, doesn't it?
I would say that would be my... I mean, fortunately, it's a one scene rather than Black Orchid Part 2. But it's a cop-out, isn't it?
Oh, James, I've just remembered. You get one of the best ever Mel scenes in this, don't you, when the bus goes up?
You do. You really do.
Oh, I can't wait.
And that's cold. That's like, I mean, how many people die in this season?
This comedy doesn't take itself seriously season, yeah.
It's got a pretty nasty body count.
Isn't everybody on Svartos
massacred? Absolutely everyone, yeah.
Yeah. There must be about 30 people on the screen there.
It's a huge cut. And they were there in a lot of scenes in episode one.
That would be me there. What's the rush? It's nice here. Oh, yeah, they did a good job there. Everyone's dashing around now. This is a really lovely tracking shot as well.
He really knows how to move his camera, doesn't he? There's a lot of variety in where he places it and how he moves and where he starts it and who he follows.
But it gets to be really grave now, doesn't he? Very serious. And they shot it at the right time of the year as well. It's sunny and it looks really cheerful.
Bonnie Langford now wearing Mel's best costume ever.
Double denim. And a neckerchief as well. Although I do kind of wish this was the Doctor and Mel going around on the bike.
It feels a bit wrong, doesn't it? They're trying out a companion, I guess, aren't they?
Although, to be fair, we have already seen photographs of Mel and Shooty on a motorbike, so we get there.
She gets on the motorbike in the end. And she actually gets to drive it, doesn't she?
Mm. And it's red. It's where it's ginger. Yeah.
I love that he's got up and put on his tie. He knows there's an alien invasion happening, but got to be smart for...
We've got a man here from the Ministry of Defence. Now look sharp, will you?
Thank you, Vinny.
But you will all have to go.
Oh, and Vinny looks so sad.
Oh, and the rest of those extras there are doing a bit of acting as well.
Oh, baby's grown again. Girl making chiming sound.
But I do like the costume, which is based on the sort of hexagons of a beehive.
Yeah. Is that supposed to be a costume, though? Did they dress the baby in the middle of the night? Is that what we're supposed to?
They're doing their best.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work. I don't think the baby's crying quite works. I think it's one thing that they didn't quite manage to sell, but it's a big idea, though, isn't it?
You see this scenery here, all this sort of rolling hills. I live at the South Downs, right on the South Downs, and there's nothing finer than spending a day just going on a ramble out somewhere like that. Oh, but the sad thing about doing this this way is we can't hear the music. There's a lot of...
So he's doing proper kind of... got some 50s sax going on in the background there.
Do you know what my favourite thing is where it goes... That's a theme tune, isn't it, to a radio show?
It's got a kind of 30s radio feel to it. I should have done some music research before doing this
shame on you of all people.
I know but you're right, it's a great choice. It works, and it's just kind of tongue-in-cheek enough to at that point. But this, all of this kind of going for the kind of major key, only Kev McCulloch could have done it like this. And it totally works for this story.
I think for a story like this, you've either got to go for it. If you don't, then it would feel all a little half-hearted.
Absolutely. Commit to the 50s-ness. Commit to the kind of up-tempo craziness of it.
Like, my mark hates that. You know, the at the end.
It's perfect. It's perfect for this story. You wouldn't want it every week, but...
I will be singing at that point. I just need to warn you about that.
Listeners, you have been warned.
No, you are, Ben. Not them. They're used to it. Oh, look. Finally, the Doctor's meeting these characters.
Do we get to meet Gromwy?
Have you seen
us? Oh, no. Oh, so those characters met them. Sorry, no. Gromwy has still not been incorporated properly yet.
What on earth would you think if you were sitting there having a nice picnic with your other half, a fellow with a question mark umbrella came up and said, have you seen a girl with a polka dot dress? I'm past here.
I don't know. I've been on picnics where I've met some pretty odd people. I think you just take it in your stride.
Really? We'll talk off mic. Mel doesn't know too much about crystallized structures, but that looks about cooked now.
It does look about cooked.
Oh, and did you... I'm sure you knew this, but this bit in a minute with the sax coming, it's a riff on the Doctor Who theme, isn't it? It's a rock and roll version of the Doctor Who theme.
I'm going to have to listen out for that.
It's like, dun, 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 dun,
at the
dun,
moment,
dun.
he's just shifting key every time music kicks back in.
Ah, it's true.
Ought to sound ridiculous, but it's got a kind of bravado that makes it work. Again, I get that if you're a Dudley Simpson fan and you just kind of feel like this had badly betrayed you.
But... there's a place for Dudley. Well,
of course there is. But
interestingly, you mentioned Roy Scammell earlier. They asked one of the other members of Havoc to do stunts for this as well, and
Did they?
he refused on the grounds that he thought the show was too camp these days. He didn't want to be any part of it. He didn't take himself seriously.
Well, if he didn't like camp, he probably made a wise decision. Would have had an unpleasant time watching this.
James, I love a bit of camp. Of course I do. I love this. I just dash in. Right. The Bannerman and Warfleet's here. We got to go.
I mean, she's been a little bit irresponsible sitting having a romantic picnic when she knows there's a price on her head.
Yeah, but look at him. I mean, you would,
He's
wouldn't
been ironized. They ought to get that
you?
printed on a t-shirt.
It probably is on
Oh, and now here we
Redbubble.
go. Da
Ah, it's great.
da 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 da.
And you get all the fellas on the side of the road with their guns, don't you? Shooting at the
Yep.
motorbike.
Yep.
Why don't people like fun? I don't understand.
That's not a bad
Okay,
effect,
okay.
really, is it?
You talk about the spaceship now.
I'm talking about the spaceship. They get better at doing that, but
I'll tell you what, there's a sequence here now where the Bannerman fleet come up to what are these two characters called?
hold caller, please.
Wise Miller
Stubby
and
cat. Wise
Hawk.
Muller and Hawk. That's
Wise
it.
Miller.
It's Wise Muller, isn't it? Yeah.
And they start blowing things up, and there's some pretty spectacular explosions going on.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing they absolutely, I mean, that this is, you get the impression that health and safety hadn't quite caught up to the Doctor Who team by this point, and they were
James, it
just,
got so
this
bad
was
in
their way
Remembrance of
to,
the Daleks, they thought there was a terrorist attack in
I
London.
know. They are brilliant explosions. The explosions in Remembrance, you don't see those on telly anymore.
No, I know. Well, it's all CG now, isn't it?
That is true.
They fake it up. But have you seen the Babel Colour tribute to the McCoy years on
I
YouTube?
haven't,
I will
no.
send you the link because not only does it feature loads of great scenes, he does a succession of explosions where it just looks like the most exciting telly you're ever going to see. I mean, it is.
Which it is. I well, don't, look, I like this confrontation. I like these two Americans just.
Where is he? Your Uncle
It's a
Sam.
comical. It's what they're doing is hard. Again, it's harder than it looks. They're doing a comedy scene with real jeopardy as well. And season 24 is constantly dallying with that, like with doing quite silly things, but with death somewhere hidden underneath it. And sometimes it just feels a bit wrong. I feel like in Dragonfire when they kill
Yeah.
all those people in a comedy way, it's just.
Well, and the sort of the cleaners murdering people in Paradise Towers, and then like the old woman's fluffy slipper sticking out the back.
It's
Tonally, it's just so
tonally, yeah,
weird.
exactly. And it's not grim enough, but it's not funny enough.
What works here is the conflict of the two sides, the loveliest group of characters you're ever going to meet, and these complete arseholes coming in to murder everybody. It works.
It
It
does
just works.
work. It's a bit of a shame they
Ah.
couldn't blow up the bus, but they wanted to keep it for Greatest Show in the Galaxy, didn't they?
Mel now lying to Gavrok.
She's great here. And look at how he's shooting her. I don't mean Gavrok shooting her. I mean, look at how Chris Clough has chosen to shoot her. It's a really, really good two-way shot.
And another heroic moment for Burton as well. Oh, listen to the music now.
Ah, now look at their
Listen.
tongues. So apparently they came
Ew.
up with that. They were eating licorice boot laces or something, and so the red mouths wasn't a makeup decision. It was just the cast going, can we do a nasty smile with our red mouths?
Well, they've got to be as loathsome as possible, don't they?
It's great.
Did you see the sea and the lighthouse behind them there as the thing was coming? It just looks
Absolutely
great.
lovely, yeah.
Keep her as a hostage. She's much more useful to you alive. Sorry, forgive me. Anyone Welsh listening, I'm so sorry.
It's all right. They've already put up with Ray's accent, so
Of course, they would go back to save Mel and Burn as well. Isn't it lovely? But you're right. That's the first time McCoy gets a big confrontation.
this all feel. I mean, McCoy, gloriously, for the reasons that I already expressed, he does a lot of kind of wandering around the countryside in various stories. And it just feels so right. Doctor Who is at home in the kind of in the British countryside.
Do you remember that bit in Silver Nemesis where it's just him and Ace whistling through the
just
fields?
Whistling.
It's great.
That's gorgeous.
Oh, you cut back.
You must
to
have
them.
Gone wandering there if that's your neck of the woods, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, what, Arundel?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. There's some lots of lovely antique shops in Arundel. It's well worth a visit. And there's another bit as well, I swear, where they're just lying on a hill listening to
just
jazz
music.
Just
lying on a hill listening to jazz. But isn't that that's
you just
one
can't
of the reasons.
See the Sixth Doctor and Perry doing that, can you?
No, always in such a hurry.
Oh, this is great. And Gromway don't ask no questions at all. He's like, oh, hello, have a bit of honey. There you go.
So who do you think Gromway is? Because there are various fan theories about...
Well, I mean, it's just a wink. It's obviously, isn't it? He's Anita Dobson.
Of course he is. That's right.
No. Well, there seems to be a suggestion that he's a Time Lord. They certainly put that
it's
theory out.
It's implied that there's a kind of... but maybe he's just Welsh, because they are very hospitable.
It's almost inviting you not to take this seriously. It goes, have you got a broom handle and a cushion cover I can take?
I like that his line to say he's going to look after the motorbike is, I'll treat it like I treat the TARDIS. If you knew, Billy, how he treated the TARDIS, you would not part with your motorcycle quite so willingly.
Somehow, the makeup on Gavrok's hands is even ghastlier than the meat he's holding.
And that's realistic. I assume he wasn't eating a real pork chop, but it's horribly realistic.
Yeah. No, God, they do detail it in like the archive or something like that, what it is. And it is real meat, but it's got something nestled inside that he can eat. But he, at one point, he spits it out, doesn't he?
There we go. And it.
Look at his hands.
Your charm is only matched by your compassion. McCoy absolutely nailing it. This is a pivotal scene, I think, in the development of his Doctor.
At least those prisoners. And actually, the way he almost underplays the last line, actually, I may have gone a little bit too far.
Yeah.
And it's
the first of several cliffhangers where he just slightly dilutes the jeopardy by an understated comedy moment.
But I do find Gavrok like a genuine threat in a way that I never did Richard Briers in Paradise Towers.
Absolutely.
You know, and as much as I love her, I never did Kate O'Mara in Time of the Rani.
He's got a glint of the real psychopath in his eyes. He's already delivered the impression of someone he's shown that he's someone who's not going to think twice about killing someone. So you feel like the Doctor's being, although he's being impressive here, and you feel like he's in control, he's got a bravery, an immediate bravery.
And he just, like, he's got a burning look in his eyes, McCoy, when he's pissed.
And you think, is he going to get away with it?
I don't think he's his best confrontation, though. I still think that's him and Sheila Hancock in the Happiness Patrol at the end.
Yes, I think that's probably right. But again, we're looking at, this is his third story in. I think that's a really impressively mature moment for someone who was clearly, from what he said, still finding his feet.
And it's interesting, you compare it to Colin, three stories in. That's Vengeance of Varos.
Mm.
Think of him up on the scaffolding and he's delivering that speech about Varos. But it's all very theatrical, isn't it?
Yeah.
McCoy's much more contained. It's like he knows he's in TV, you know?
I think it's where his experience doing all of those TV programs, you know, Jigsaw and was it Tiz was the other one. All of that actually, you know, for all that looks like very kind of slapstick stuff, learning to pitch it to the TV camera was quite a skill, and it's very different art now.
It's what Hartnell always used to say to Peter Purvis, isn't it? It's like TV's small. It's small.
Yeah.
Keep your gestures small. McCoy gets that.
That's the thing about it was wonderful. The thing about McCoy is he gives the impression of being very wild and all over the place and slightly out of control, but actually it's a very self-contained performance, and his movements are very carefully judged. I mean, it's no surprise that one of his heroes is Buster Keaton, because you absolutely see the similarity, but the physical control, the ability to go full on crazy and to you know, do things at the apparent expense of your own safety without worrying about it, but also the smallest movements in the eyes.
What do you think's McCoy's best performance?
I think it's probably Ghostlight.
I would agree.
I think that's his most nuanced performance.
But I do find
good things to say about a lot of them.
I think the story that plays into his talent the best is Greatest Show of the Galaxy.
Absolutely. And that's gets a phenomenal performance.
To perform at the end, doesn't he? Yeah, all of his tricks and...
What other doctor could have walked out of that tent and not flinched? Whatever human being could have done that? Again, Buster Keaton is the answer. That is pure Keaton that moment.
What they need to do with McCoy, and it's actually something that Big Finish frequently forget, it's just, I think his weakness is when he does sort of Blazing Anger. He can't sell Blazing Anger. So when he's screaming, you know, let this be our last battlefield and if we die like animals and all of it, I never buy him when he's doing that sort of thing.
But Righteous Indignation, so, you know, barely controlled rage, like at the end of that episode, he does really brilliantly with that, when the way he says the word life.
Yeah, he's wonderful, isn't he?
He is. I think there's something, a kind of alchemy that is, and I feel sad for Colin Baker when I think too hard about, you know, what happened going into this season. And I always feel a bit kind of, a bit like I'm betraying an actor who I also have a lot of time for. And
yeah, you
know, I will always rush to the defense of Colin Baker. But I'm glad that McCoy took over when he did, because I just feel like he suits this version of the show so perfectly.
I actually think Colin's more impressive because he managed to find so many moments of charm and humor that wasn't there,
in spite of the material he was given. Absolutely,
and that he had that brilliant renaissance on audio afterwards, where he could show what he could do.
And fortunately, the Colin we know now is a much more well-rounded performance because he's been given the opportunity to do that. But I still watch Attack of the Cybermen with admiration. You know, I feel that has a kind of energy to it as well that is also very impressive for the circumstances he was under.
Oh, you better not listen to the season 22 Strictly Come Hamster coming out next week then. Little spoiler. Well, look, James, I'm having an enormous amount of fun here. We should probably
Everybody's having fun. Anyone not having fun with this story is not a real person.
We don't want to know you, all right? No, we do. Every opinion's valid. But shall we head on to the climax of this fabulous story?
We absolutely must.